And I just think I'm really lucky that I'm able, you know, to really take that wonder that science has gifted me. Because, you know, like, I think it's available to everybody, but when you are actually studying it, like you said, for, you know, 13 years of your adult life, and then see it yourself and work with cells at the microscopic level, and you know, then experience life at the macro level, and then just like blend your spirituality into it. There was not a single moment in my graduate studies life when I was doing experiments or science that I wasn't just like so connected to my spirituality and my belief systems, because it's just so incredible to witness that type of level of life.
Welcome back, everyone, to I'll Have What She's Having podcast. I am your host, Amber Samea, and first of all, I just want to say thank you for being here, thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting this humble little love offering of a podcast from my heart to yours. I am very grateful today to be able to share an interview with you that I had yesterday with an incredible woman who walks a line between two very unique identities as both a scientist and an artist, a creative. And her name is Irene DeBrice. And Irene is a bioscientist. She knows a lot about viruses. She knows a lot about what is going on with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes the COVID-19 disease. And she was generous enough to share some of her time with me yesterday to really go over in detail some of the information about COVID-19. The benefits and the impacts of social distancing, the root causes really of where this virus comes from, and the concept of One Health, which is where human health, environmental health, and animal health all combine into one focus, into one health, where all of those things we recognize as impacting each other, and how we can really honor that interconnectedness. It was a really lovely conversation. It was refreshing, and Irene provided a lot of insights that are maybe different than your average scientist. Irene is such an incredible woman. She is a Costa Rican bioscientist, certified holistic health practitioner and herbalist, mystic, and self-taught artist. During her formal education, she completed graduate programs in biosciences and also completed an MS in natural health and lifestyles in 2011. Much like our reality, her life has been split in a dualism. On one facet, her scientific body of work has revolved around molecular virology and most recently, infectious disease epidemiology. On the other side, she has held on to natural artistic skills since early childhood and has sought nourishment in natural health studies and practices, lifelines that have helped her manage a lifelong struggle with anxiety and high-functioning depression. She aims to live her life humbly in service to humanity and anchored in the Socratic paradox. All she knows is that she knows nothing. Okay, well, welcome, Irene, to I'll Have What She's Having podcast. I am really
feeling blessed and fortunate that I have this time to speak with you today, and that you have been able to offer your time to me and to all of our listeners. And I just wanted to start off by giving you the opportunity to introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're at this moment.
Well, thank you, Amber. I'm very happy to be here, and it's also a great opportunity for me to be able to speak with you. So thank you very much. I'll start by saying hola. That's hello in Spanish. And just to say, I originally come from Costa Rica. I was born in San Jose, Costa Rica, and raised there as well. And since I left, I've been studying. So I've studied a lot for basically all of my life, and I ended up studying biology. I spent biology undergraduate, master's, and PhD degrees, and I ended up focusing the research component of those studies into virology, and more specifically molecular virology of RNA viruses, which include HIV as the majority of my research background, but then also other ones like the cousin of HIV, which is called HTLV, which is a human T lymphotropic virus and causes leukemia in adults, so kind of the opposite of HIV, and other emerging infections, kind of like the ones that we're seeing and experiencing right now in the world. And aside from that science, I've been drawing and painting since I was a little girl, and the reason why I'm focusing on that a little bit now that I have more time is because art has been a lifeline for me and struggles that I have with and chronic anxiety disorder and persistent depressive disorder in the form of high functioning depression. Mm-hmm. So definitely a hot mess.
Welcome to the party. Welcome yes. to the party. Yeah, thank you so much for that introduction. And so what are you working on right now creatively? What is an art piece that sort of has your focus and your love and your attention right now?
So right now, I am very lucky to have thought of this baby project in 2012. And because of school and everything, I hadn't had the chance to really sit down and sit with it and, you know, kind of like think about it. But ever since I finished my PhD, I've had a little bit more time to kind of slow down and really give it its proper thought and time and nurture. And it's my website. So it's called, my creative portal is called Pura Prana. And it's just a place for me to kind of share what I'm doing in terms of illustrations. Most of what I've done so far are illustrations. And in the past year, I graduated from this amazing program in intentional creativity that is called the Color Movement Teacher Training Method. And it's just incredible. So I'm trying to implement that into my offerings, which so far are just a coloring book. So I'm really working on developing that aspect of the website. I don't really have, you know, much going on it right now because I'm so busy between my day job and then, like, you know, life. But I'm really trying to simply sit with it and just let the creativity and inspiration flow as it comes, and trying to make a real beautiful offering for whoever is searching for the signature or energetic signature and things that I have to offer.
Thank you. And I love your drawings. They're incredible. And if anyone wants to, if you're curious and you even want to check them out right now, you can find Irene on Instagram at Pura Prana, P-U-R-A-P-R-A-N-A. And there's some really, really powerful illustrations there. And I just want to really acknowledge that I am so moved by your artwork and by just the depth of emotion that I feel when I look at them. I think there was one that you did for the Australian bushfires.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, where there was like a woman with a koala on her back, and there was the flames and the eucalyptus trees. And you'll know what I'm talking about, listeners, if you check her illustrations out on Instagram. But yeah, it was, when I looked at it, I actually really did feel this like holding and this beautiful intention that you had put into this image. And yeah, thank you for just the depth of love that you put into your art and your creations, because it is really felt. There's a resonance there for sure.
That is really good to know. And I think that, you know, just jumping ahead or backwards, we'll find out. that's just, you know, part of the reason why I've been doing this, or why I'm even bothering doing this in this point of my life, is just that, like I said earlier, art is my medicine, my daily medicine. Contemplative practices are my daily medicine, with the type of, you know, I don't want to say, I guess, mental disorder to a certain degree. I don't like tagging or putting labels on that type of thing, but it's like my way of navigating what's going within me, as well as the suffering that is also happening in the world. So I try to kind of like congregate that into my illustrations, and in that way I'm able to process everything that's going on.
Yeah, there's a really deep honesty in your work and like in your art creation. I don't like to call it work. You know, and I really believe, Irene, that all of us are, as human beings, are on the razor's edge, right? With our mental, emotional wellness. We are these incredibly beautiful beings who are on this complex earth with so much uncertainty. We don't always understand what's happening. And there are times when we vacillate between, you know, intense periods of joy and experience happiness, and there's also depths of struggle. There's depths of depression and despair and anxiety. Anxiety has been a really big reality for me in my life as well. And also art has been a way for me to really be with that anxiety and to express and to process and to just like get something from inside of me, outside of me. In a way that I think is also healing for others. So just acknowledging you in that, you're not alone in that. And I'm so with you, sister, in that experience of, yeah, it's funny, we call it mental disorder sometimes, but I don't think that we're disordered. I think that in a lot of ways, we're just responding as sensitive beings to the way that the world is impacting us, the way that the modern society, especially that many of us find ourselves embedded inside of, is drawing forth these responses of anxiety and depression. And I'm actually a really big advocate for not internalizing that or localizing it within ourselves as saying like, this is something that's wrong with me. I feel like there's something right with you. There's something right with me when I am impacted by the world, and I do feel sad, and I do feel afraid, or I feel anxiety. I think it's because I am actually within the realm of accurate response from my body, my emotions, my spirit. And so I really like honor each individual person when they can be brave enough to even say like, I am struggling with this, or I have depression or anxiety. Cause it's like, yeah, you know what? And there's something right with you that you feel that entirely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know that I don't want to minimize the fact that people do have like some clinical levels of depression and anxiety that definitely need to be supported, and whatever way they choose to be receiving support for that, I totally support and advocate and love and accept. But yeah, just want to really give presence to anyone that's listening as well, that these feelings that we are often feeling in the world of depression and anxiety and low-lying sort of, I don't even know what the word would be, like melancholy, it's a part of what we're experiencing as a collective, and how we are still showing our interconnection with all life. You know, because I am interconnected to this world, I feel the feelings of this world. I feel the feelings deep within me. And I think that's a beautiful thing And so anyways, just honoring you for that and for the way that you bring the beauty within your soul into the artwork that you do. And you are a very fascinating and dynamic woman in my view, because you are, like I had said before in our previous conversation, this woman that's sort of between two different worlds. And they're not necessarily, don't necessarily have to be two very divergent worlds, and they might be more integrated within you, but within the culture and the paradigm we live in, to be both a creative and an artist, and then also a very highly trained scientist, can seem like a bit like a juxtaposition. Has that been your experience sometimes in how you have been developing yourself between the artist and the scientist?
Yes, I it's been extremely difficult for me, you know, maybe it's fueled or in a way related to, you know, like my high functioning depression that I've had since I was a little child and I can remember. I mean, now that I know, I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. But I think the problem for me has been in fitting inside the box, right? Like when you are pursuing a highly advanced academic career and degrees and so such, there's a certain, you know, archetype that you're expected to fill in and behave as. So for scientists, you know, like that would be, you have to be very responsible and you have to be very serious and critical thinker and rational and logical and that kind of stuff. So I loved all of that. And again, like I love having studied life. That was really something that has influenced my work a lot as well as an artist. And then as an artist, you know, I was always ashamed of not being able to say, oh, I'm an artist. And I also, I'm a highly spiritual person. And, you know, like that, I think that artist world is more welcoming of a scientist coming in. Mm-hmm. But the science and more, you know, disciplined fields are not necessarily so embracing of, I guess, the woo-woo or how people call it nowadays. And that part of aspect of art and spirituality and how they blend, because, you know, usually they have very conflicting views in terms of, let's say, just an example, evolution versus creation and things like that. So mm-hmm. it's been definitely a juxtaposition, and it's something that I have only learned to embrace once I finished my PhD. That's when I was like, okay, I'm done. I have time. Let's start working on my art now, seriously, because, you know, I'm done with degrees, so I can be whoever I want now.
I love that. Yeah. I know it does feel that way because it's something where it takes so much of your focus, so much of your energy. Mm-hmm. And to be divergent from that, especially when it comes to art and creativity, because art and creativity can pull you into a vortex. Like it can pull you into a world where time stops and everything drops. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so
yes.
I can see how trying to get your PhD and be, you know, a wild, flourishing artist at the same time would be challenging, mm-hmm. to say the least.
Yes. But I just want to add something, you know, like I think we have this view of scientists as people that don't have creativity or are very left-brained. But I think that in all honesty, scientists do need and have a lot of creativity. It may not be expressed in the traditional way we think of creativity, you know, like art or film or music or something, but, you know, to be able to ask the questions that we ask and, you know, design the experiments and just like read all this literature and put the pieces together and form a story. It's definitely a different type of creativity, I think. And without it, we're lost. So without yeah. it, I don't think there would be any science.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the sciences are highly creative fields. And I think that you, exactly what you're saying, I totally agree that there is a high level of creativity and curiosity that exists within scientists, which has driven them to become scientists. And it's not easy to become a scientist. It's years and years of dedication of your life. So, know, yep. it's interesting for you to be integrating that. And I did read in the amazing article that you were featured in from Mary Margaret Kelly on the Archetypal Woman series, and you had written, and I'm going to quote you here, "I started thinking of how to integrate all of this, and that's when I was able to give word to my calling, art medicine, my personal collage of science, art, and spirituality. My work and offerings explore the mythology and science of the biosphere, space cosmology, the contours and fields of the human experience," and that's HUEMXN, human experience, "and my personal ancestral mythos." So that sounds like a profound kind of space of integration that you have kind of now made your way towards.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's so important, I think, when you are able to give that word to whatever it is you're feeling or wanting to create or experiencing. And I just think I'm really lucky that I'm able, you know, to really take that wonder that science has gifted me. Because, you know, like, I think it's available to everybody, but when you are actually studying it, like you said, for, you know, 13 years of your adult life, and then seeing it yourself and play, well, not play, but like work with cells at the microscopic level and, you know, then experience life at the macro level and then just like blend your spirituality into it. There was not a single moment in my graduate studies life when I was doing experiments or science that I wasn't just like so connected to my spirituality and my belief systems, because it's just so incredible to witness that type of level of life, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's difficult for a lot of people to imagine viruses, for example, since we're in that type of scenario and experiencing that right now,
baby.
but definitely, like, you know, they exist, and again, it's not easy for someone that has never studied or been in that type of, you know, like research environment to actually say, okay, like, you know, this is how things look and this is how things work, and I think it's just a huge blessing to be able to have the skills, artistic skills, to blend in with your experience and whatever knowledge you have accumulated from studying into something that maybe can help someone understand their position in this reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that I was wanting to have you on the podcast is because I do really respect the training that you have in the biosciences and your understanding of viruses and virology in particular, and in the light of where we are right now in the world facing what has been declared as a global pandemic with COVID-19. I am really curious to get your perspective, both as a scientist and as a person who is weaving art medicine and is a bit of a witch doctor.
Yes,
I say that tongue in cheek.
But it is how I've been called by some of my colleagues and during graduate school. So I take it with pride.
Yeah. And I think because you are just at this really unique intersection of the sciences, the arts, you also, like, where you are located, you're, I guess I would say, you're in the global south at this point. And yeah, just having all of these pieces in place for you, your perspective is very unique. And I think also I want to hear from you where you, not necessarily where your position is on this, but how are you looking at this COVID-19 pandemic in terms of where it started, where it's going to go, and maybe some of the things that we can learn as a collective from this experience of this pandemic? We'll start with that, and I do have some more questions, but let's see where you take it from there. That's a lot to start with.
Yes. And it's such a difficult place for me, you know, because people know about my background and like I'm their point of information. So and when I say it's difficult, it's because, you know, like we've discussed before, I am deeply scientific, but then at the same time, I'm like deeply spiritual. And it's just, you know, a hot mess. Let's say that again.
But yeah.
So I don't know. I can just start to, like, you know, maybe say a little bit about the coronavirus disease. The virus that causes it has been named SARS-CoV-2. So that's the virus. And COVID-19 is the disease that it causes. So basically, this virus is a new strain that was discovered in 2019. And it is new. It has not been previously identified in humans. And the reason I think that initially, like, there was a lot of comparison to influenza, but then now we know that it does have a higher mortality rate than influenza. But the thing is that it's new, right? So, like, humans don't always or do well with new when it's scary. That's why so much attention has been given to this virus. Coronaviruses are zoonotic, so that means that they are transmitted between animals and people. And for me, that means that, you know, we are still kind of invading that natural habitat and the natural ecosystems that exist and remain on the planet, because we're expanding. You know, there's always more population increments. You know, I can't speak to how many per day, you know, but we are still expanding as a human race and human population. And, you know, that means that people need space to live, and then there's going to be more hunger or a need for protein. So that's when we are increasing this type of interactions between the natural world, which includes the animals that carry these viruses in the natural world, and then also us humans. So when we have this kind of increased interaction between animals and humans, then we're going to see and most probably keep seeing this type of emerging infections. So, and for example,
I was going to say, is the interaction with wild animals, or is this when we're actually sort of industrializing a production of a certain animal?
It could be both. So, so in terms of these emerging infections, I think like this one's, for example, like other coronaviruses that have occurred in the past that have caused outbreaks, like SARS-CoV, the first one, 2003-2004, was transmitted from civet cats to humans. And then the MERS, which is another coronavirus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, was identified to originally be in dromedary camels. So this one is believed to come from bats. But, you know, in terms of industrialization of animals, that's one of the places where we really do global surveillance of farms, especially in Asia. A lot of chicken, for example, in the world comes from Asia, to make sure that there are not novel influenza viruses coming, like avian influenza or swine influenza. And the thing with influenza is that the genome of this, all of these are RNA viruses. So most of the emerging infections that we have seen or will see are RNA viruses. And influenza has segmented genome. It has 8 segments. So that's why that one, for example, it's like on the top of the list in terms of surveillance, because like it has higher chances to kind of like, you know, recombine with other viruses.
Okay.
So, but yeah, for coronaviruses, I just think that, you know, like, for example, this new COVID-19 is thought to have come out from a Wuhan wet market. This is where they have like expansive areas of caged wild animals that are still alive, and they're caught in the wild, and then they're just sold as either delicacies or
regular food. And again, that's all cultural and also driven, I would say, by culture, but also by the need for protein, again, that we're saying with like increased population.
Mm-hmm. And so how does COVID-19 differ from like the regular influenza virus that, you know, say we would get a flu shot for every year, for those who choose to get a flu vaccination? How is it different, and what are the differences in terms of the risks and how it spreads and how quickly it spreads and so on?
So I think, like I mentioned, influenza viruses have segmented genomes. The coronavirus is a single-stranded genome, so like one strand of RNA. And this one in particular is new. So, you know, again, a lot of the questions that are asked of health officials right now, you know, we're still in that point in the pandemic where there's not enough information or data to decisively say this is how it is and this is how it will be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of a vaccine for a coronavirus, that remains to be determined. There are multiple groups around the world working on that. And I think influenza's case fatality rate is about 0.1%, whereas globally, COVID-19 has been shown to have around 3.4% deaths per confirmed cases. And then, you know, in the older age bracket, so like around 75 or 80 plus, we are seeing a higher case fatality rate, about 14%. And that's because, you know, of age, and they have more underlying conditions and maybe more fragile, you know, health prospects in terms of fighting a respiratory illness like this one.
Right. Yeah, and I did read an article the other day that I think there was a group of Canadian researchers who had isolated the virus somehow, and are, you know, at the point of trying to understand it more. But it seems very clear that there's a whole scientific gap in terms of what we actually understand about the virus. And I know that gap will start to get filled in the next couple of months. But in the meantime, yeah, I think that's what's feeding some of the, let's say, some of the panic or the fear, is just that sense of the unknown and not really understanding what the potential is for this virus and its long-term impacts. And we are seeing, you know, it seems like there's been quite an increase of cases. And I know in my own community and in British Columbia, the province I live in Canada, we are being encouraged to do the social distancing. Mm-hmm. And really that is in particular in order to protect those who are vulnerable. And there's a lot of people who are vulnerable in our communities, whether they're elderly, whether they are immunocompromised, whether they are living in poverty or in conditions that would make it really difficult for them if they were ill to get well. There's just so many people that actually do fall within that vulnerable category. And I think one of the things that I've been thinking of is what is the best response that we can have in terms of weighing in the balance our fears of the unknown and the things that, you know, science has actually been able to show us will actually work to help prevent the disease from spreading, and how effective those measures are. So if we do socially distance and, you know, we become, like, I saw an image that was so great where it was a line of matches, and there was like, mm-hmm, six matches were burned and one match like was lower than all the other matches. And that was the example of social distancing. And so it stopped the fire from spreading to all the rest of the matches after that. I thought that was a great image, but is that actually something that we can rely on? Is this something that you would consider as helpful, and for how long? Like, what is your perspective on the approaches that are being taken in, you know, let's say most of the world right now to prevent the spread of this disease?
So I think for me, it has been definitely very interesting to see it spanned from the first reports that emerged in early January from China to what it is now. You know, and of course I have my group of virologists and medical doctor friends, and we were all like in our little WhatsApp or Snapchat group talking about it and just witnessing it. In terms of the spread, for example, just as an additional comparison, right now it is estimated that the basic reproductive number, or R0 or R0 for SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes this disease, again, COVID-19, is estimated at about 2.2. So that means that one single infected person has the ability or will infect about 2.2 others on average. By comparison, the flu has an R0 of 1.3. So again, like we're seeing a more slightly more contagious virus. And to me, the speed at which it has really propagated throughout the world really illustrates one of the, I guess, the reasons why we are having this pandemic in our modern world. It's because of this globalized, international, much more accessible travel. So that's been number one. In terms of social distancing, I think that it works. Most of the population, I mean, all of the human population will be naive or susceptible to this virus because it's new. And I think, I'm not like an expert. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but reading some of the outcomes, for example, from South Korea, who have been doing a lot of testing and also have been implementing this more stringent, public health lockdowns to keep people from interacting with each other unless they absolutely have to leave the house and so forth, has proven to kind of like give them a better control of the number of cases. So I think, you know, I always keep on telling everyone I'm more afraid of humans right now than the disease, because panic and fear are more contagious and more dangerous than COVID or SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 at this moment. I think when people panic, and I guess this fear may come from not being familiar with what's going on or not being familiar with viruses, and this type of emerging infections can really, you know, do or have, you know, worse consequences. So I think that my recommendation to my friends and my family is that, you know, we need to kind of like be good citizens, and instead of being fearful citizens, to just like take a deep breath. And, you know, there's not much we can do right now, right? We're not invincible. And I think this is another reminder in, you know, in my crossover between spirituality and scientists, that we're not invincible. I think humans at some point started believing that we're invincible and nothing can take us down, and, you know, so forth. So definitely just heeding the advice of public health officials. I think a lot of people may pass judgment, but you know, like in my line of work, we actually do work a lot. And the people that are in these fields of public health and epidemiology and science, like, that we're not there because we have to, you know, like often this type of jobs are not like high paying jobs. So, you know, like we're definitely there because we have a passion for, you know, infectious diseases and public health and, you know, really doing that type of disease surveillance that can give us early indicators that there's something wrong going on and how can we stop it as soon as possible. So definitely social distancing if you can, if you're able to, you know, like if your work says like you're going to be teleworking, then telework. Don't go to parties. Don't go to like a concert or something in this point. I know that a lot of events are being canceled worldwide. A lot of restaurants and coffees and every anywhere that a significant amount of people can gather is being closed down. And I, you know, it's a little bit shocking, I think, because we haven't had one of these scares in a long time or this type of pandemic or transmission. But I think it's definitely better to, you know, be cautious, because again, like, it's the surge capacity
capacity. Like, I don't think, honestly, any country in the world at this point has the type of surge capacity, medically speaking, in their hospitals with healthcare workers and such to really, you know, tackle the amount of cases that they could see. So social distancing and teleworking and just being smart, you know, just wash your hands. The most important thing you can have is soap and water.
For 20 seconds, people, a full 20 seconds.
Yeah, 20
at least.
Seconds. Sing happy birthday to you while you're washing them. But, you know, it's not so much as in like you're going to get infected and you're going to die. No, that's not what we're doing this. We're doing this to protect the people that could or are at higher risk of developing severe disease. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to lessen that caseload because, again, like, hospitals have limited capacity, right? So we don't want everybody to get infected right now, because then that's when we're going to have a problem. If we have like a more staggered, you know, curve of infections, that will make it more manageable. And if we can flatten that epidemiological curve in terms of like not as many cases as we could have, that's definitely going to be the best. So I know it's hard and I know it's difficult to kind of like have our lives interrupted, but I think at the same time, you know, from a more spiritual point of view, it's definitely a call to slow down, mm-hmm. A call to meditate. I think it's a great opportunity for us as a collective humanity to sit down and wonder and ask ourselves, why is this even happening, right? Like, we've definitely seen an increase in disasters and other things in the past 10, 15 years. So it's like, why is this happening and what can I do? You know, sometimes it may feel impossible in terms of curving or trying to help and, you know, save the planet and so forth. What can I do at an individual level right now to help with the situation and in moving forward, try to decrease the impact that we're having on the planet that is making this type of emerging infections get out of the animal population.
Yeah. Well, it's also been really fascinating to see the ways in which, you know, our lives have been disrupted. That's the word. It does feel disrupting, or, you know, being forced to slow down. But then on the other end of that, for many of us who have been looking at, you know, the sort of impending climate destabilization and the result of being at this sort of point in late capitalism, we've all been wondering when the other shoe would drop, you know, and how do we slow down the greenhouse gas emissions, and how do we actually move the dial a little bit? And I was thinking about the fact that even having people socially distance and staying at home and not driving and not traveling on airplanes for an extended period of time in the world, I don't know how long it's going to be. That's actually, in a sense, answering a call that we've been putting out for a long time, right? Like, can we actually slow down as a global collective? Can we actually consume less? Can we stop? Can we spend more time with our families? Can we spend more time doing the simple things in nature and creating and, like you said, meditating? And one of the outcomes that I'm really hopeful for in the midst of this pandemic and, you know, the suffering that is there, and I just want to say before going any further that I acknowledge so fully that there are people, you know, that are dying from this. Like, people have lost family members and will continue to lose family members. And my heart is very, like, really feels that weight. And I'm also in the other end of that, holding that space and that realization that this is also teaching us as a collective how slowing down is possible, and that there is a way for us to sort of shift how we have been going at such a crazy pace in our consumptive, extractivist world that we've been living in. And in this moment, this is sort of a change point. And so I'm seeing that happening as well, and noticing mm-hmm. that sentiment from many other people. And yeah, thank you for just offering that perspective. And I think the social distancing thing is, it's just been for me interesting because I've had to cancel a couple of events and just be totally okay with that and reimburse people their money and just totally be okay with that. Mm-hmm. But I'm also noticing that people are banding together in a way. So we're isolating as much as we can in our homes and with our families, but then there's been this awareness of sort of a network of connection as well, where it's like people asking each other how they're doing. Can I drop anything off? Do you need toilet paper? That's been a big, big one. If you've run out of toilet paper, we can lend you a roll. So I'm also seeing a reemergence of what I would call community resilience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also something that we can feel far away from or not recognize. Like everything is so top down and so, you know, government organized and mandated. But then sometimes when something like this happens, you see that ground up response, right? From the grassroots of how we as people really do care for each other deeply. We care for one another. We want to help each other and support each other. And if my neighbor was ill or needed something or couldn't go somewhere because they couldn't risk being exposed, I would be happy to share with them or do what I could to ease the situation that they're in. And I'm noticing that in a lot of others as well, is this emergence of goodwill.
Yeah. And I can really speak to that with our experiences with Hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017 in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. That's definitely something that was very palpable in our communities, you know, everybody taking care of each other, and especially very much like in this particular pandemic we're going through, like taking real care of those elderly that may not be neighbors, that may not be able to go shopping or get to the shopping mall or the store and it's already all, you know, sold out. So in terms of taking care of our elderly community during this pandemic, I would say, you know, please do it, but then also take extra precautions since they are the vulnerable population. So if you do take them food or, you know, toilet paper, or whatever it is that they need, that you practice as much, you know, sterile technique as possible. Like, mm-hmm. you know, don't send a sick person, right, to give them that those goodies.
What could and that I just look want, like, mm-hmm. Just in terms of being extra precautious around a vulnerable person, what would that look like?
You know, just wash your hands before you take it. And maybe if you can, you know, so at this point, like there's a lot of scarcity in terms of like, you know, Clorox wipes and other, you know, like sprays or whatever it is that you normally use to clean. But like, you know, if you do have a Clorox wipe, I personally would take that extra step to take, you know, any toilet paper or honey. One of my elderly neighbors wanted honey. Like I would, if I can spare that extra Clorox wipe, I would just like give it a wipe, wash my hands before I take it over and just be like, here you go, bye. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So
like just leave it outside the door maybe with a little note or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to add something in terms of like what we were discussing earlier about this whole emerging infections and the contemplation of why is this happening or how can we slow down is that in 2006, I think around that time was when this new kind of like initiative was born out of the different influenza outbreaks that happened in the early mid 2000s, and that is called One Health. And it's something that has been adopted by, you know, like a lot of national and international organizations and public health and so forth, like, you know, and UNICEF or FAO, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the CDC in the United States. And One Health is, if you imagine like a Venn diagram with like three circles, it would be the intersection of human health, animal health, and environmental health. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a recognition that environmental factors can impact human health. And, you know, that recognition can, for example, be traced all the way back to the Greek physician Hippocrates. So it's like, you know, how are we impacting that environment
like we were discussing earlier, and how is that impacting their animal health that is impacting us? So that's something definitely, like, you know, in terms of science, that's definitely where we are headed, or we've been headed since, again, the around mid-2000s. How can we improve this from that interdisciplinary scientific approaches to prevention, education, investment, and policy development? But again, like I said, you know, that's like I dream of this utopic world where we'll actually like listen and do all these things, but it's a different reality. You know, if you ask me about my spiritual perspective, or my, I don't know, bio-spiritual perspective, I would definitely, you know, based on my belief system, which is very towards Mother Earth, and the respect for nature and the sacred of nature and our planet and our world, and everything is sacred to me. But definitely I would say that, you know, for me, this is just yet another message that we are perhaps not doing the right choices. And again, like, you know, in terms of what you're going to speak about very soon, taking responsibility, it all starts with our, with choice. It is a choice we're making, whether we want to keep on going the way we're going and seeing the outcomes that we're seeing, or do we want to try something different?
Yeah. Yeah. And what I was feeling before too is, you know, just a recognition that we did collectively cause this, and we didn't cause it intentionally, but we caused it through a lack of awareness on how our actions have consequences in the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, there is a part for us that we have played in this, and I'm really taking that to heart at this point. And it is this time where I am slowed down and I am able to think and reflect. It's really considering my privilege, considering my consumptive patterns, considering how the things that I have are often coming from, you know, the labor, the cheap paid labor of other people and other countries. And just so many things have been coming into the forefront for me right now about the absolute impossibility of trying to disconnect myself from this. Like, it's not possible for me to actually not be impacted by this in some way. And I actually see that as a good thing, because if that's the case, then we're being impacted and we're actually being brought back into interconnection at some level. Mm-hmm. And so that is part of what I would say is something I'm taking to heart in this part of the experience. And I mean, it's not really even impacting me personally that much right now, other than some minor disturbances, minor disruptions, needing to take more precautions and protect people that I love from getting ill. But yeah, it's a time where I feel like our humanity is also being called forward in a much deeper way. And like you were saying too, not to try to find the cause, like one singular cause, like this person or this group of people or this country or this particular meat trade as being the cause of this. But it's so much more than that. It is many, many different moving parts. And like you said, the privilege of leisure travel around the globe that has been taking place for how many years now, like over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that we don't always think about the fact that that traveling has some pretty intense impacts as well. You know, not just the emissions, not just the carbon footprint, but so many other things, like this, like bringing illnesses across the world. Yep. So,
yes.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And then on the other end of this, so we know that what we can do is listen to our public health officials, follow the guidelines for social distancing, be as careful and precautious as possible when we're around anyone who is considered in that vulnerable category. And we actually don't know how long that's going to go on either. So we also have to just be willing to kind of ride this wave as long as we can. And that means that a lot of people are probably going to be losing income from jobs, or if they're entrepreneurs, from businesses they may have where they've had to cancel pretty much everything on the roster. And so there's that other element too of rising to the occasion to support each other. Because some of us are going to be impacted more than others. And then there's, you know, definitely on my radar right now is communities who are already experiencing poverty. And I wanted to get your perspective on what it looks like within impoverished communities to be dealing with a disease like COVID-19.
You know, it's definitely more difficult, right? Especially depending on where you are. Most of these communities are often rural or geographically distanced from major cities, not necessarily rural, but you know, it's accessibility to food. If you are already, for example, in the United States, we have food stamps. If there's an interruption to that, then you could be affected in terms of obtaining food. If you don't have fresh water, you know, a lot of communities in the United States don't have access to fresh water. How are you expected to, you know, wash your hands or, you know, stay as healthy and as calm as possible if you are in a community that is, you know, historically underserved and underinsured? There may not be enough human resource capacity to manage this type of outbreak or pandemic in the community, or hospitals as well, you know, like access to medical care. And if there are, you know, like often rural hospitals don't have the capacity to see a lot of, you know, like if there's an increase in cases in the vulnerable population that need medical attention, like first of all, there's not enough doctors or nurses or equipment to take care of these patients. And something that I was learning or reading about in the last month or so is that, you know, at least in the United States, in the last 5 to 10 years as well, like there's been a lot of close downs of rural hospitals because of lack of funding. So that's also a huge problem. So again, like, you know, I would say that, you know, whether you're in a big metropolitan city or you're in a rural area, I mean, there's going to be differences, but again, like if you're in a metropolitan city and you have a lot of infections, that medical capacity is still going to be impacted. You know, again, like we don't all have, like there's not enough surge capacity if like worst case scenario happens, you know?
What do you mean by, did you say surge capacity? Do you mean like a surge of patients coming in?
Yes. So like, you know, you have your normal population that, you know, like are receiving dialysis or, you know, ER beds and our inpatients. And then you have the surge capacity would be like, you know, how many more ventilators do you have? How many more beds do you have that you could spare to address a surge in cases or patients that are coming in?
Like 50 people showing up one day.
Exactly.
Well, mm-hmm. I think that's what they're experiencing in Italy, if I'm not mistaken, is that the challenge, the reason that they've had so many more fatalities is because they haven't been able to, they don't have that surge capacity in hospitals there. And so they've basically had to make some excruciatingly difficult decisions around who lives in and who dies, which is...
I know. And that's heartbreaking and it's really difficult. But I don't think anybody's at fault because our systems are not designed to deal with this type of emergency. And, you know, like we saw, I mean, we're going to see this, that type of Italy scenario all over the world if they have such high case numbers, because, you know, like in other countries like Iran, they've had quite a few deaths as well. And again, like, it's not just the virus. It's not COVID-19 that is killing these people. It's an exacerbation of any underlying conditions that they have. Or, you know, like, I think I read somewhere that the most deaths have occurred from heart attacks or cardiac arrests or,
oh, really?
You know, like, Mm-hmm. So with any disease, you usually don't die from the disease itself, like from the viral infection itself. You expire from your immune system's reaction to it. Either it's too little, or in most cases, you know, like whenever you have like meningococcal disease and meningitis or any other type of bacterial pneumonia or something, like when there is death due to pneumonia, it's usually because your immune system is trying to fight so hard that, you know, it is, you know, the immune cells that will clog your lungs in that example. So it's like usually, again, just your body reacting to the viral infection or the bacterial infection that will, you know, cause death. But yeah. So we saw that in China as well. Remember, I think everybody saw it with like non-belief when they built those hospitals in a matter of a week, I think 6 days or something, to be able to deal with the amount of patients that they had.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I am feeling very aware of, though, is that there are some places in the world right now where that wouldn't be possible. You know, they wouldn't be able to respond that way. And I mean, in particular, I'm thinking of war-torn areas like Syria, you know, or places where you have refugee camps, and they already are not able to treat people's wounds in hospitals because they're at capacity, or they have makeshift temporary hospitals set up that are not able or capable of treating, you know, like you said, this surge of people coming in. So I recognize how important it is and why it is so important that if you are able to keep yourself healthy and keep yourself out of the hospital, the people who really need the care and the treatment are going to be able to get the care and the treatment that they need. And that's only true here in a place where, you know, like I'm speaking from a Canadian perspective, where we have a pretty well-equipped healthcare system that is still not as equipped as it needs to be. That's where I've really started to understand, because at first I thought, well, I mean, it's true. I had the thought of like, well, it's not such a big deal. If I get sick, I'll just be sick and it'll suck and then I'll get better. But then realizing actually the best thing for me to try to do is not get sick in the first place, so that I don't ever have to be someone taking up a space in a hospital where a vulnerable person really needs to be treated. And then I just have this, I'm just giving presence to this real heaviness in my heart for those communities around the world, those cities and those spaces where they don't actually have healthcare that can meet the needs before this virus even started.
And it's, you know, like you were saying, for me, at least personally, someone who normally feels all the feels in the world on any given day, and it's just impossible for me not to feel it, and it's exhausting, and it's, you know, sometimes like it triggers some form of despair in me, because it's like, what can I do, you know, what can we really do? And again, that's where I'm hoping that outcomes from this experience that we're all having collectively, because it's impressive how widespread it's being. It's basically in the whole world. It will be in the whole world.
Equalizing some aspects of our coexistence here.
Exactly. And how can we move forward together? How are we going to move forward? And in terms of, you know, I just wanted to add something that is very close to my heart and my background and, you know, my culture and so forth, is that, you know, that one health movement or initiative that we saw, you know, mid-2000s, around 2006, put about, you know, like human health, animal and environmental health being interconnected, and, you know, they all need to be healthy for everything to be healthy. To me, it really just reminds me of indigenous cosmovision. That's what all or most of the indigenous cosmovisions around the world talk about, you know, nature and Mother Earth is a sacred living being, which depends on all other living beings, including, you know, in their cosmovisions, like stones, water, earth, air, and all the creatures that inhabit the earth. So all of us, all beings have the right to life, respect, and even to be consulted. And I think that you know, like when you look at those both of those definitions side by side, they're basically saying the same thing, except one is more like, you know, spiritual and a whole culture, practices, traditions, and the other one is more scientific.
Yeah, they are two sides of the same coin.
Yep.
And that's the inquiry that I'm sitting with, and I'm also offering now to everyone who's listening is, you know, what is our relationship with the sacred? And for those of us that do believe in what you've just said, Irene, and I am one of those, and the indigenous cosmovision, which is also, you know, very present for all of us who are sort of emerging into a more earth-based spirituality now, is, you know, what is the voice of the earth asking for? What is the mother asking for? And how can we respond to that? Because there's a different energy right now. There's an invitation to tune into the subtlety and to really, really feel it, to really feel, like you said, feel the feels. And we need to feel, what is the voice of the animals? What is the voice of the water? What is the voice of the ecosystems? What is the voice of the marginalized communities? Even what is the voice of the virus? You know, what is it? What is it saying? What is it asking? And I would invite each person as a way to be participating with your own feelings and your own experience of this right now to perhaps take a moment and ask that question, to sit with it in meditation, or maybe do some drawing or some journaling and just see what comes forward for you. And if there is just a way for a deeper connection to be formed in this moment.
Collaborative reading by Irene DeBrice and myself from a beautiful reflection Irene has recently written. We will do this in both Spanish and English.
¿Qué nutre tu fuerza creativa?
What nurtures your creative force?
¿Qué te trae un gran respiro de vida?
What brings you a deep breath of life?
Para mí siempre ha sido el estar inmersa en Madre Tierra.
For me, it's always been being immersed in Madre Tierra.
Es respirar sus fitoncidos específicos a cada bosque, pasar tiempo en su canto sagrado, en su sagrado silencio.
To breathe her forest-specific phytoncides, to spend time in her sacred chant and her sacred silence.
Aquí puedes escuchar el pasado, presente y futuro de nuestra historia planetaria.
Here, you can hear past, present, and future of our planetary story.
Llévate a este momento.
Take yourself to this moment.
I think those are beautiful and very important inquiries and meditations that we all need to be doing.
Yeah, I so appreciated what you had spoken to, and with so much respect and awareness for everybody's different spiritual path and tradition, but you said that you do see this as a moment of thinking about what our relationship to the sacred is, or our relationship to life. And I'm curious for you, I mean, let's talk about what we are doing and what we can do within our daily lives to be making that connection. But what does that look like for you, Irene? What is your relationship to the sacred? How are you honoring your sacred practice? And what is keeping you in the space of connection and love for all life at this time?
So for me, I think, like I've mentioned before, my point of connection and kind of like my spiritual practice above all else is art, illustration, painting. But I'm from Costa Rica, and Costa Rica, with all its problems and, you know, developing country issues, I think we have really taken a kind of like a place in, or a leadership role in terms of the global community about conservation, you know, of biodiversity. And, you know, we're so tiny. I think we're the size of West Virginia in the United States, and we have 5% of the world's biodiversity. So that's such a huge thing. And I grew up immersed in that, and I consider myself so blessed for that. So even though I was raised, you know, old school Catholic, I always had that connection, I guess, since birth to the earth. And I really took advantage of that. So for me, you know, like, nature is such a huge part of my art. You know, like, I can't draw or paint without first spending some time with a tree or a flower or whatever it is that you have accessible in your community. Not everybody has, you know, jungle next door, but definitely, like, seek that nature and just sit with it and like, I don't know, I guess it's like a very personal connection at the individual level, but definitely, again, like, feel what they're saying, or just spend some time with it. And in terms of choices, I mean, it's really difficult, you know, because I think we're also immersed in this consumer culture. That, you know, now that when you really start looking at your life and how you live your life, it is difficult to walk away from certain conveniences. But for me, like, you know, I've been doing this for at least 5 years, especially since moving to a location where we catch our own rain, and that's all we have for water. I mean, that I in Costa Rica, I grew up like that, you know, like, be very aware of water. There was always so much education for children in my school or just anywhere about, like, water conservation and so forth, but I never really grasped it until I was in a experience where, oh, it hasn't rained for, like, you know, 8 weeks. So, you know, really tapping into that conservation at your individual home level, you know, don't leave the tap water running. And I know it sounds silly, and I think, like, a lot of people don't really understand what the impact of you leaving the tap water running, because we tend to fall again into these little bubbles, and then we forget where the water's coming from. A lot of people don't even know where their water is coming from. So, you know, it's like, and then assessing the rest of your life, you know, like, can I take the bus? Can I walk? Can I carpool? Can I stop buying so many clothes? I mean, I personally don't really shop that much. Like, some of the things I'm wearing right now are like 10 years old, and you know, and I know that, like, you know, it's been easier for me because of, as a scientist, like, literally we just work in our pajamas basically with a but you know, like, sometimes I even felt the judgment of friends, or maybe it was just inside my head, maybe it was out of judgment, like, oh, you don't look fashionable enough, you're still wearing that, you know. But at this point in my life, I'm like, I don't care. It's like, do I really need to buy this thing? And something that always has been a major pet peeve for me all my life is trinkets or clutter, you know, when you go, especially like maybe in tourism industry or or like little shops, and you just like see all this clutter, or like even Target, or, you know, toys, and they're all made of plastic, and it's just like, it's again like that inquiry, daily inquiry, and that awareness that you're talking about, like, do I really need this, and what do we really need to live? And well, for me also, in terms of, you know, taking that approach, it's like I've been relearning how to grow my own food and catch my own water, and, you know, I try and I opt to go for a plant-based diet. My husband eats meat, but you know.
Yeah, usually, I think that's important as well to give presence to you, is that another thing that we can be doing is reducing our meat consumption as much as possible. I know it's not possible for everybody, but there is a way to reduce that consumption, even if you can't totally eliminate it. So
yeah, and I think that, you know, like other questions that I have asked in posts I've made about, you know, this bringing this awareness to the current pandemic we're going through, is like, you know, other questions could be like, are we willing to stop traveling for pleasure?
Yeah,
you know, like for Instagram photos, because we need to go to this place and take this photo and be cool. Or are we willing to invest in global family planning programs? Are we willing to stop spending so much on things that are not necessarily super, well, to me, super important?
Yeah, but I think that the nature of consumer capitalism is to encourage us to, it's basically like manufacturing need, right? And that's something I do want to talk about, is that a lot of the things we think we need or we want are manufactured needs. It's something that literally through marketing and through all kinds of psychological ploys, we are feeling a pressure to purchase and buy things and have things and decorate our homes in certain ways. And also on top of that, a lot of the stuff we're buying is not good quality stuff. We've actually completely let go of quality, you know, and this is one of the things that we can relate to because we've been through intentional creativity teacher training together, is when we make something with intention, there's just something so precious about it and so beautiful about it. And most cultures in history up until the Industrial Revolution and just family and community groups, we were making things from the natural world that were beautiful and meaningful and significant, and they were quality items. They lasted a long time. People would make their own clothes and then they would repair their clothes for years and years and years to keep that one item of clothing, you know, keep the longevity of it going. Or a family would use dishes and they would be inherited generation after generation after generation, the same set of dishes, the same set of candle holders, the same blankets, the same tapestries, you know. And this type of intentional, like slow cooking of our creations and our offerings, like those things are beautiful and they have so much value. And that is also something that I see a return to when we actually can let go of the sort of cheap manufactured stuff we don't need, is we can make a return to quality. We can make a return to having intentional items in our home spaces that we have maybe a very deep or familial connection with, even through generations. Like I don't think I own anything except for maybe a couple of things from my grandmother that have been preserved through the generations, because my family is a like a white settler family in a consumer culture, was getting stuff that was not stuff that could be passed along for generations. And so there's this whole other aspect too, where we have an opportunity to return to intention, to creating with intention, and having items that mean something. And that's what I'm hoping for in some place, in some part of each human being, is that we start to really weigh in the balance. Like you said, do I really need the things that I have? Do I even really love the things that I have? Or are they just, they're just stuff and I'm just keeping it around? So along with that kind of frame of thinking, I am curious how you feel in your own life right now about sort of prioritizing creativity in the time when things are, you know, a bit crazy. I don't know what other word to use. It does feel a little bit crazy and overwhelming in the world right now. There can be a lot of pushback sometimes from even from family or friends or people who are maybe just operating in a different framework, that creativity is sort of like an indulgence, you know, or you'll get to it when you have time for it, but there's more important things to be focused on right now. And I've been sort of seeing that dynamic and just sitting with it and just feeling into it. But I'm curious for you, what does creativity look like in your life? What does it feel like? What does it do for you? And how does it contribute to your personal resilience?
So I would love to say that during times of struggle and turmoil, I have had time to paint. But for example, you know, in during the hurricane, Hurricanes Irma and Maria response, I was the first responder. So of course, like, to a certain degree, I'm a little bit jealous of everybody else because, you know, like, people were like, oh, we were at the beach and we were, you know, painting or drawing, and I didn't have that privilege.
Yeah, that wasn't me.
And then during this pandemic as well, because of my line of work, during the day, because at nighttime I try to be an artist, and during the weekends, if I don't have to work, I also have to be very engaged in the response in my community. But anytime that I am able to do art or creativity, I do it. You know, like I've mentioned before, art is my lifeline. It's my prayer, my altar, and my primary spiritual practice. And moving forward, you know, like with all my art, I would like to transmit that, you know, like that type of Australian illustration you were talking about earlier. But for me, the healing I've experienced with creativity, the easiest form would be a blank paper or a canvas in front of me, has no comparison to anything else. And I think that in times of, you know, again, like stress or, you know, go, it is, or pandemics, it is incredibly important, especially if you are home and, you know, your social distancing, to take that time and explore yourself. You know, there's nothing more beautiful, but nothing more daring than having like some, like a blank page in front of you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be, you know, like a lot of the discussions I have with the people I work with in terms of art is that, you know, people think that art or creativity is just painting or drawing. You know, there's so many different types of creative outlets. You could do crafts, you could do, you know, your own songs, you could do your own films. With your iPhones now, everybody has a smartphone. I mean, the capability of recording of these devices is huge. You could cook. I mean, cooking is one of the most beautiful intentional creativity practices there is. Mm-hmm. You could garden, you know, and I think it's extremely important because there is some alchemical aspect to creativity that, you know, changes things in you. It may give you more calm or give you that relaxation that will help with your resiliency in facing difficult times.
Yeah, and I recognize for myself too, in situations where I'm in the middle of something that is really calling for my attention, that means I can't show up at the canvas or to my writing or my music, I sort of look forward to the time in the future when I will be able to go to those things, because I know that they'll be there for me as a way to process my experiences and the stress that I've been under, or the suffering or the tragedy. Like, I've recently been through some tragedy in my family, and right in the moment of tragedy, I obviously was not able to be creating or painting, but it was afterwards where that became such a place of refuge for me, such a sanctuary, to be able to go into that art, like you're saying, and just be present there. And it is like such a deep medicine. It's another form of medicine. It's a medicine for what I would call the soul. It's a medicine for the heart. And yeah, it's a deep place of resilience for me. And I'm really hoping to be able to offer space for others as well when the time is right to hopefully maybe do some online creativity. I know we can't all be in the same spaces right now, but I know we're going to find ways to be resilient together and creative together. And just kind of moving forward from there and towards wrapping up our conversation, I just wanted to hear any more insights from you or thoughts that have come up in the course of our conversation that you would like to share with our listeners, and just give you some space to sort of just express whatever you feel guided to express without necessarily having to answer the prompt of a question. And you're welcome to take a moment to just sit and reflect on what that might be.
I think that in terms of our whole conversation, if I had to pick something that has really stuck with me, and, you know, whether it was present there before or not, is to really take that time like that to practice the call that you made in terms of inquiry about where we are, and not only as a collective, but as an individual person, to really, you know, especially again, like if we're teleworking or you have a little bit more time because you're not running all the errands that you normally would be doing, just use the time to sit quietly with yourself and ask yourself all those questions, you know, like, why is this happening? Why are we experiencing this? What does that mean? What would I like to see come out of this? What would make me feel better? And, you know, trying to be honest with yourself and exploring, you know, one of the most important questions that I like to ask is, you know, what is sacred to me? And, you know, perhaps even assess how you were raised. And, you know, if you'd like to explore other cultures or traditions, it's like, what would be sacred for me if I haven't asked that question before? You know, is it water? Is it air? Is it, you know, many other things? And really just find that time. Like, even if it's 5 minutes, I would say, like you said, sometimes we're so busy to really explore that creativity. But I think creativity is our birthright, mm-hmm. One of our birthrights. And, you know, we are creative beings. Like, we were born to create, whether it's technological innovations or art or food, you know, that's in our bloodline and our spirituality, if we choose to have one. But definitely just try to connect to yourself. And when you do, you will find that, you know, you will connect to everyone else. It's for me, it's an impossibility to not be connected to everything. So definitely just sit with that and the whole aspect of one health, you know, it's like one humanity, one world, we are in one planet, you know, like one health is human, animal, and environmental health. And how can we bring balance to that? Of course, that's almost impossible in itself, but what choices can I make in my daily life? I think if we all make a little choice every day, that will collectively have an impact. And just to really dwell in that, you know, one health mm-hmm. Concept. And, you know, just to illustrate, you know, one more thing about this whole virus and case load and death load and so forth, is that a lot of the deaths, for example, that were seen in China and Iran were in men and older, you know, to a certain degree, that older population. But other factors to consider aside from the virus and the disease and, you know, age and so forth, is that in these locations, there is high environmental pollution, right? There's like a high degree of air pollution. So, of course, this is a respiratory illness that's going to have an impact. Another, for example, trait that this men have or these cultures have is a high prevalence of smoking tobacco, particularly in men. So, of course, that's going to have an impact as well. So, again, these are all kind of like within that spectrum of environmental, human, and animal health. And I think that's something that we all need to move to in terms of our actions, choices, and contemplative meditations that we have.
Thank you so much for that very, very beautiful reflection. Really feeling it from your heart and your wisdom. I am curious to also hear from you, because you are a holistic health practitioner as well. What would you say are some of the things that we can do while we are social distancing and we're sort of at home just trying to take care of ourselves and stay well? What might be some things that we, like foods we can eat or teas we can drink or anything that you would recommend from that sort of more holistic wellness perspective to help support ourselves in this time?
I think that, you know, I can talk about it, and you know, it's very common sense, right? It's eating foods that are going to support your immune system, because you want your immune system as, you know, ready and as strong as possible. Mm-hmm. Definitely decrease alcohol consumption. I know that some people like to drink a little bit more when they're at home or when they're quarantined, or, self-home quarantined, but yeah. Definitely try to decrease that. But then again, like, you know, I want to say, you know, like try to consume a lot of citrus, right? Like lemons, oranges, things that are high in vitamin C, drink teas that are going to support your immunity.
So the vitamin C thing is real. And vitamin C is important.
I mean, I believe in it, yes.
Yeah.
But I just think that, you know, a lot of these things, you know, I could say, like, eat as many vegetables as you can. Maybe do some herbal immune broths and so forth. But the thing with, you know, like, all of this that is difficult for me, and it's part of the whole conversation we've had, is, like, a lot of this, you know, like, home care also comes with privilege, right?
Yeah.
Like, did you have access and money to purchase oranges and lemons and ginger and garlic and, you know, like herbs like elderberry or tulsi or mushrooms, you know, that are medicinal to in the midst of shopping spree panic, you know, like if you don't normally have these things in your home, right? So or like, you know, to make bone broth, you know, whether you're vegetarian or not, you know, if you're vegetarian, veggie broth, like this is all a matter of accessibility. And, you know, from experience, you know, after emergencies like hurricanes, like a lot of people don't have access to that. Like, we didn't have fresh food for a long time after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. And, you know, that's not a reality for a lot of people. So if you didn't already have this dried herbs and, you know, even frozen stuff, you know, the hurricanes, for example, like I think COVID-19 and this coronavirus is different than a hurricane, because hopefully, you know, power is not going to be interrupted for months and months at a time. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have that, even that capacity to, you know, like make a bone broth, because we didn't have a freezer. But unless you already had all these things in your home, it's going to be very difficult. But yeah, just like, since this is not a hurricane and we have power, I would just say, you know, like try to stay as healthy as possible, you know, just eat veggies. If you have herbal access to herbs, you know, try to find some that are accessible, and, you know, make broths. I think broths are really good at this time. There's a lot of, you know, immunomodulators that can be things that maybe some may sound weird, but like astragalus, reishi, tulsi. And again, like in the northern parts, all of this is going to be dry, right? Like, I don't think anything's growing there right now, unless you have a, what is it called?
Like a greenhouse?
Greenhouse.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, something like a reishi mushroom is
expensive.
Well, and it's actually kind of hard to grow unless you have a certain setup for it. But yeah, we do have accessibility to a lot of these dried herbs. Like my partner and I have, we are actually folk herbalists, so we collect these things and they're in there when they're in season and we dry them and we have these teas and things. So I will,
So in that case, it would be like, you know, maybe shiitake, maitake, turkey tail, and elderberry is one of my favorites for immunity. So if you can have some of those, you can make tea, you can make syrups, you know, all that good stuff.
And I wanted to add to it because you bring up such a powerful and important point, right? It's remembering that some of us have access that other people don't have. And so there's also some items you can get in a grocery store because the grocery stores will restock. The shelves might be empty for a while, but they are being restocked. And there are some, you know, teas and tea bags and bags of oranges and things that you can actually donate to your local food bank as well. If you are in a place where, you know, the food bank is going to need a lot of extra support in all communities. And we do have poverty in my own community in Squamish. We have poverty, pretty intense poverty in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. It's like the biggest concentration of homeless people in our country. So the food bank will need support. And, you know, let's think about the health promoting foods that we can get from grocery stores that food banks will accept. And let's do our best to actually donate more of those foods to the food bank so that they are accessible for those who need them. And that, again, that goes for anyone who lives within a country, a community, a province or a state where we have mandated services like food banks. But that's one thing you can do is think about consciously what you're donating to the food bank right now and how that food could potentially support the wellness of somebody else.
And that's beautiful. And then also water, right? Like water is life. So, drink lots of fluids and, you know, just do like what you would normally do if you're preparing for an influenza season or, you know, like the common head cold is a coronavirus as well. And I think a lot of people didn't know that until now. Yeah. So it has a wide range of, you know, like the diverse viruses in this family have like a wide range of symptoms and severity. So yeah, just like, you know, don't panic and just, you know, practice what you would do if you were entering influenza season, which usually starts in October in the Northern Hemisphere. And just like be smart, use common sense. And again, like my second most important message, I guess, after what you asked earlier is don't panic and don't fear. Just take a deep breath and wash your hands for 20 seconds and don't touch your face, you know, when you're like running an errand to the supermarket and so forth. Just, you know, try to, sometimes, you know, like we don't have a choice in terms, you know, let's say like if it escalates, you know, maybe we won't have a choice to buy that type of healthy food, but then, you know, don't be stringent or hard on yourself, you know. I think that, you know, for me, that's something that is very present at all times. It's like when I travel home or to other more impoverished countries, it's like, you know, the privilege that comes with being like, oh no, I'm not going to eat that because it's not vegan or vegetarian or organic, you know, that's a huge amount of privilege. So it's like, you know, just take care of yourself the best way you can.
And that's probably something that is also really good for us with privilege to be learning at this time when we are losing access to certain entitlements and the things we've come to expect are not there when we expect them to be there, is that the normal that we live with is actually quite exceptional compared to the normal that most of the world population lives with. And it's actually going to build our resilience and make us more interconnected people of depth and compassion and love to be able to connect with that new normal. I think it's a good thing. And I think that we have the capability of letting go of some of those expectations and realizing that half the things we think we are entitled to or need, we can actually really live without and be okay without. So yeah, thank you for giving presence to that. And thank you for the perspective that you bring from someone who has been at the front lines of experiences like Hurricane Irma, where you've been in communities that have been underserved and have had to also be advocating for health and wellness and recovery and resilience in whatever ways are possible for human beings at that time. Mm-hmm. And that's what we are, I think, are all going to need to learn in the new normal that is our world now, is how can we work with the raw materials of what we have and share with each other and care for each other and do the best possible we can to advocate for each other's wellness and wholeness. So it's that's another inquiry that that I think I'm just going to leave lingering. Yeah. But Irene, thank you so, so much for giving your time today and your emotional labor and your brain and your heart and your spirit and just all of it to this conversation. I just really honor who you are and what you stand for and the place that you hold in this world. It's really beautiful, and you're such a gift. So thank you.
Thank you to you too, likewise.
I'll have what she's having.
Thank you everyone for tuning in to today's podcast episode. I really hope that this information was helpful and supportive, that you feel a connection to accurate and factual information and also drawn again into the other end of the spectrum, which is the spiritual, the sacred, and the somatic. You know, what are you experiencing within yourself? What are you feeling? And how are you wanting to be connected to all life right now? What are you reconsidering? And I do leave you with that inquiry and let it linger and just asking, who are you right now in the world? And what is being asked of you? How are we going to be in service to life, in service to the sacred, which for me is anything and everything that pertains to life? The music that you heard in today's podcast episode was an original vocal composition made by myself, and I sang it off of my medicine drum, and it was just from my heart to yours. Enjoy. If you enjoyed today's episode, I would be so appreciative if you could give us a rating or comment on Apple Podcasts. That is always helpful with a small show getting started, just so other people browsing through can have an idea of how it's impacting those who have already listened. So thank you in advance for the review or the rating, and thank you again for being here, for being who you are. I hope you have a beautiful, beautiful day.